Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Planet Talks discussion on natural rights. My name is Tanya Ha. I'm a science communicator and an environmental advocate, and I'm absolutely delighted to be your facilitator for this discussion here today. Now, I'd like to start by acknowledging that Wurundjeri is being held on the Taumatulla on Kaurna land. We recognise that the Kaurna people are the original owners and custodians of the Adelaide Plains. We also acknowledge the elders past and present, and also acknowledge people from other First Nations who might be here among us today. And how beautiful is Taumatulla here today? Who is really, it is just a glorious afternoon. So who here is having a good time? Great food, great music. Who's loving that? Who loves this natural setting? Who's been just absolutely enjoying the trees, the river, the nature that surrounds us? It's pretty special, isn't it? And I think it's one of those things that you don't quite like to say, because it's very lush and green because of this thing called La Niña, which is wreaking havoc in the eastern states. But I am kind of enjoying that it's not too dusty and it's so lush and beautiful. But look, getting on to the subject of today's discussion, we are going to talk about rights, particularly the rights of nature. And people assign rights for themselves over nature all the time. So we've given ourselves the right to extract from nature. We've also given ourselves the right to protect nature. But what happens when you give nature its own rights? What happens when we extend human rights to the earth? And when policy fails, can the legal system step in? Can we get lawyers onto people who are doing something that is harming the environment? Well, we have a panel of experts here today, community leader and advocate and scholar Anne Polina, and legal scholars Erin O'Donnell and Peter Burden, on recognising personhood in the ecology around us. This Planet Talk is made possible thanks very much to the sponsorship of the Environment Institute at the University of Adelaide. Now, I'd like to welcome Andy Lowe, Director of the Environment Institute, to the stage to say a few words. Please make him welcome.
Thanks very much, Tanya. I'm Andy Lowe. I'm Director of the Environment Institute. It's great to be here today to support this event. These discussions are critically important that we chunk through the key issues that are facing society. The University of Adelaide and the Environment Institute work to halt and reverse environmental decline. We work on biodiversity, water. We work on nature-based solutions in our natural, urban, and our production landscapes. But it's no use that knowledge just sitting on the shelf of a laboratory or an office. Universities need to engage in the public debate. We need to get out and work with partners to implement these solutions. And these types of public debates are a critical part of that, which we wholeheartedly support. And we have a number of our members participating in the Planet Talks over the next 3 days. And as a side, if anybody's interested in what the Environment Institute do, or you'd like to send some questions through, then please contact us at the website. Thank you very much, Tanya.
Thanks, Andy. And thanks again to the Environment Institute for hosting these events, the opportunity to discuss some really important ideas while we're enjoying food and music and culture is something that is really precious. And I do want to encourage you to share the things that you hear today with the people who couldn't make it. So if there are people who are outside the tent and you think, oh, they'd be really interested in that thing that Anne just said, then feel free to tweet using the hashtag #ThePlanetTalks. And you could also tag at WOMAdelaide. So I'll ask people to turn their phones on to silent, but I won't ask you to turn it off because then you can't share the insights that are going to be brought to you by this fantastic panel that we have here. Now, I'd like to first start by introducing, let's start in the middle, Professor Anne Polina is a Nyikina. I need to practice it. Nyikina Wurra woman from the Kimberley region of Western Australia, an active community leader and a human and earth rights advocate, filmmaker and respected academic researcher. Now, Anne is also the Murray-Darling Basin inaugural First Nations appointment to its Independent Advisory Committee on Social, Economic and Environmental Sciences. She's also a Peter Cullen Fellow for Water Leadership. She's won a truckload of awards because she's, you know, an internationally recognised expert and advocate in this area. But one of the things that Anne has said is that she believes we can dream together as human beings and start to live in harmony with each other and with our non-human families. Otherwise, Mother Earth will be lonely without the vibrations of human beings. Please make her welcome.
Sorry.
Now, Dr. Erin O'Donnell is a water law and policy expert at the University of Melbourne Law School. Erin is recognised internationally for her research into the groundbreaking new field of legal rights for rivers. Her work explores the challenges and opportunities these new rights create for protecting the multiple social, cultural and natural values of rivers. Since 2018, Erin has been a member of the Birrarung Council, which is the voice of the Yarra River in Melbourne. Erin works in partnership with traditional owners across Australia to identify law and policy pathways to address aqua nullius and increase traditional owner power and resources in water. Please make Erin welcome. And finally, we have our local here, Peter Burden. He's Associate Professor at the Adelaide Law School at the University of Adelaide. He's an expert in environmental philosophy and law and has written or edited 10 books on topics ranging from earth jurisprudence to the evolution of law in the Anthropocene. Peter has also written extensively on the rights of nature and has travelled to Ecuador to study its operation in the Constitution. Please make Peter welcome. Now, so that you can get to know the people on stage together, we're going to start by answering a question, which is, I want our panellists to tell us about a river or a natural place that means something to you and to sort of set the example and to try and sort of curry local favour. I thought I'll start off by saying a natural place that means a lot to me is Brownhill Creek or Willa Willa. Because I spent my teen years in Adelaide, and if you follow up Brownhill Creek, then there is a little footbridge in which that was my place during my teen years that I would cry when I needed to cry. And then if you go further upstream and into the Mount Lofty foothills, then there's a quarry, and there's a really large rock in that quarry, and that rock is where I would go and sit and think. And they're thinking and crying, two extremely important things to do when you're an angst-filled teenager. But I think just that experience of being cradled in nature, it's no surprise that that's where I went to think and feel. So they're my little places. I'll now ask Erin, you know, tell us about a natural place that means something to you.
Thanks, Tanya. Hi, everyone. It's an absolute thrill to be here with you today. The natural place, I feel like I've been to so many special places around Australia and in different parts of the world, but the place that means the most to me right now is the Birrarung, the river that runs through the heart of Melbourne, our upside down river. And the reason it means so much to me, I think I can talk a little bit later about what it means to be on the Birrarung Council, but this is a river that Melbourneians have been just mildly embarrassed about for a long time. It's a brown river. We go to Sydney and we look at the incredible harbour. We come to Adelaide and we see these extraordinary beaches. And then we go back to Melbourne and we have our upside down, often rubbish-filled river where you can't actually touch the water because it is so rich in bacteria in its lower reaches and its pollutants. But we love it. We love it anyway. And for me, that's the most powerful experience of being connected to the Birrarung, because it doesn't owe us its health or its vitality. We can love it anyway, and then we can care for it and help it improve its health and well-being. So the Birrarung is a reminder of our capacity to build relationships with the natural world, regardless of how pretty it looks or how safe it is to touch.
I have to ask, why is it called the Upside Down River?
It's called the Upside Down River because it's so brown. It looks like all of the silt that would normally sink to the bottom is actually flowing along on the surface. And it's actually a function of the nature of the type of silt particles that we get in this river. It's a young river. It's continually changing and evolving, and so the rocks are creating the silt, and they're quite flat particles. So even when there aren't very many in the river, it's very easy for it to be cloudy. Now, at the moment, there's a lot of reasons for that pollution. Stormwater is one of them. The rubbish that people leave around on the streets. It's a sad river, but it's a beloved river, and that's important.
Very true. And lastly, tell us about the natural place things that continue.
Mabubara, Nanyunilla, Walan, Polina, Nayu, Yimadawara, Man, Nai Mandajara, Nigananga, Nai Mabumori and Ganda on Ghana land and living waters. So, in my language, I said that welcome and acknowledging the lands of the Ghana people, their living waters, and their country. Nayu Yimadawara Manan. Nayu Yimadawara Manan means I am a woman who belongs to the Madawara, the Fitzroy River in the Kimberley region of Western Australia. That river has created my identity, my love for a special place that is all about what we call the River of Life. So it's an amazing river system, 733 kilometres long. It's National Heritage listed. It belongs to everyone sitting in the audience. It's also the largest registered Aboriginal cultural heritage site in Western Australia. So it is a river that our people have forged the oldest sporting industry in the world on. It's magnificent. We laugh with it, we cry with it, we dance with it, we sing with it, we tell stories, we build new stories. So we're watching other rivers across the world and across this nation. And so this is a very, very special place. Ngāiu I Marawara means it has created our identity. The law of the river was created by Marawara. And so therefore we are bound as Indigenous people to a moral obligation from the beginning of time to live, love and protect that river for generations to come. So that's why I'm so passionate about this sense of place. The Kimberley is magnificent. Once you go there, you're always a part of it. But it's about sharing our stories, sharing our songs, but also to what we call wake up the snake. Wake up the consciousness of the people to understand that rivers are life, and that they belong to each and every one of us. And we have a moral obligation in this country to what the elders say where I come from, to stand and defend the rivers and protect them, because rivers are under great stress, not just in this nation, but across the world. So it births life because it is the river of life. We hear it, we sing with it, we cry with it, we tell it stories, we create new memories with those of you that come to be in this special place. So, looking to share some more of the story, but for me, that is a special place because it has created my identity, it has created the laws of the land, not laws of man, and it is a very special place that belongs to each and every one of you sitting in the room. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Peter.
I grew up in a small town called Sandy Creek. And Sandy Creek has a water system that flows through it, which is not as magnificent as the Fitzroy River, but it was special to us growing up. And it was our play space. It was where me and my friends would gather and get dirty and muck around. And as we grew up, subdivisions came over and took over a lot of the land that the river ran through. And I'd like to say that we were practicing some kind of taking back of private property or commoning. We weren't really, but we still played in that river and walked through people's backyards or that creek, and it was still really important to us. And I'm thinking about it in response to your question, because it was the first place in nature where I'd established a connection and which felt important to me.
So I'm going to direct sort of my first sort of, you know, question about, we're going to get into the guts of, you know, legal systems and that sort of thing today, because this is how we will protect rivers and natural places. Erin, can you give us a bit of an introduction? What do we mean by natural rights?
So I think what we're here to talk about is rights of nature. And so you mentioned in your introduction the rights we tend to assign to human beings, and we tend to give ourselves certain rights to undertake particular activities, particularly the right to dominate and exploit nature. So this idea of rights of nature or rights for nature emerged because people were looking for ways for nature to push back against the domination and exploitation of particularly Western legal systems. So this idea has been around for a very long time. It started to really crystallise in the 1970s with a paper by an American professor called Christopher Stone, who just started to muse one day in his property law class. So you never know, inspiration strikes in the oddest of places. He mused what it would mean for nature to be able to go to court itself, for the law to be able to see it as a person, to see the injuries to nature, and to take those injuries into account when the law was considering the damages that human action had caused. So up until that point, it was impossible for the law to see the damages to nature except through the lens of human damage. So if we think about damage to ecosystems, there's an awful lot of damage that can happen before there's a direct damage that can be assigned to a human person. And the court simply couldn't take that into account, and so damages that were assigned to people who caused environmental harm were too low. So this was his idea, was to say, what if we could get nature into court? And it could start pushing back, it could start showing the harm that is being done to it. Would that be a way of levelling the playing field? So this was the kind of origins of the idea. It's come through many permutations in the 50 years since Stone's original thinking on this. It's now embedded in constitutions like Ecuador. It's picked up in legal systems around the world, and there are a lot of community groups in many different countries, including here in Australia, really pushing for this legal change. It's also been led by Indigenous peoples. So the idea that nature is deserving of rights, that it should be visible to the law, is something that can sit within Indigenous laws, but it's not usually expressed in terms of these adversarial rights. And so that's probably the other bit of this equation to keep in mind here, is that rights are often only honoured in the breach. Mm. So if we think about assigning nature rights, we are forcing nature to fight back against us when we hurt it, rather than thinking proactively about what kind of relationship do we want to build with nature in the first place.
Just to make this a bit more tangible, can you tell me a bit about the example of the Whanganui River? I gather that's been sort of a bit of a landmark piece.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Whanganui River flows in New Zealand. It was the location of a treaty dispute settlement between Māori and the New Zealand government. So unlike Australia, who does not have treaty with Aboriginal peoples, this is something which now is beginning to be rectified. The processes are underway. But Māori and the New Zealand Crown have a treaty, the Treaty of Waitangi, Te Tiriti o Waitangi. And that should have set the basis for a better relationship. The New Zealand government, of course, managed to ignore many of the treaty provisions for over 150 years. And so what gave rise to the Whanganui legislation and its recognition in law as a legal person was an agreement between Whanganui iwi, the people of the river, and the New Zealand government. And the river is recognised in law as a single, living and indivisible whole, with all its physical and metaphysical elements, from the mountains to the sea. That's the beautiful recognition. That's come from Whanganui iwi saying, this is how we see the river. The settler state law in New Zealand, of course, was trying to come up with a way to recognise Māori rights to the river, but also not hand over ownership of the river to Māori. That was a step too far for the New Zealand government. So the circuit breaker was to recognise the river and let it own itself. So the river is now a legal person with all of the rights, duties, liabilities and powers of a legal person. And so these two pieces of the legislation sit kind of uncomfortably together, but also they are in conversation with each other. One is the recognition of the river as a living being that we are in a relationship with, and the other is of the river as a legal person with the power to fight back, the power to sue and be sued. And so it's a really interesting space to watch what is happening in Aotearoa as these ideas kind of jostle together to see which one ends up being dominant in that space.
And that's actually, it's interesting, given that the Māori people were part of this conversation, and Australia, we don't have the same kind of treaty. Do you think that this is something, what do we need to do in Australia to give rivers rights, to give natural places rights, and how does that sit alongside things like an Indigenous voice to Parliament, recognition of the Constitution. Are we trying to do too much too soon all at once, or how do you see this playing out? What are our priorities?
Yeah, I think the first thing is you have to be brave. You're challenging a system that is imported for each and every one of us. So these laws have come from England, and what we are saying as Indigenous people is that there is already a law of the land. And when I heard about the Whanganui, I was so excited, and I went back and I sat on the riverbank, and I said to the other elders, oh, do you know a river in New Zealand has been granted personhood? And they looked at me as if I was from some other planet, and they said, E, not a human being. The river is not a human being. It is an ancestral being. We communicate with it. It created our law. We have a relationship with it from the beginning of time. So in order to look at what does justice mean, it is a hard conversation in our own nation to hear the voices of our people, let alone the voices of rivers. So this is a really important thing, and what we're saying is that rivers are ancestral beings. As I said, it created my identity. It created the law of the river. It created the opportunity to not only look after my nation and my tribe, but the whole of the river has created its own law. So what we're talking about is a clash of values, a different way to see and be in the world. And what we're saying is that these conversations that have started in New Zealand with Māori people talking about rights for rivers and then extending it to Australia, to the Yarra, to the Birrawong, and then for us to be brave in the Kimberley and push the boundaries and say, well, our river already has a law. It has its own standing. It has its own merit. It has its own perception of how it is valued, but most importantly, what is the relationship to all people? So as I said, the river created our identity. It created our law. We live by a moral law of obligation to protect that river because it is a river of life for life. And so, as Indigenous people in this country, we've learned to navigate our way through what I write about as lawful, awful laws. They are no longer fit for purpose for human beings, let alone the environment. And so when we talk about rivers' rights, this is even further down the story. So who could imagine? I come from a really crazy place called Western Australia. I hope I've got fellow colleagues in the room, but who would have thought that we would create a law to allow the willful destruction of sacred sites? This is in a nation that has standing across the globe. And so what we are looking at, and this is why I said we have to be brave, because the conversations that we have need to come from what we call bottom-up governance, not top-down, toxic, centralised power. So the people of the land are speaking. So this voice of justice for not just rivers but for our people across this nation really needs to be looking at how do we frame this so the voices of the people in the most remotest area can have their voices privileged, how rivers can stand and have standing, how mountains, as in New Zealand, are standing and saying, we've been here from the beginning of time. It seems a no-brainer to me that we as humans who just navigate through our life for 100 years, if we're lucky, are standing here and challenging a concept that how can a river have rights? How can a river have standing? So it's a conversation that we need to have. We need to have it with like-minded people who want to publish, who want to push the boundaries. But at the end of the day, it is all about your relationship. Your relationship with your land. Your relationship with the living waters that you've found as you navigated and walked through this country and found these beautiful sacred spaces. You need to build a relationship with it. You need to hear it. You need to feel it. You need to understand that your DNA is now embedded in this landscape. You are part of living memory. And so rivers want you to hold this. They want you to know it. They want you to give them three words that we have: respect, relationship, and responsibility. And so this is the way that we must navigate this pathway. The other point I talk about when I say we have to be brave is that as Indigenous people, we do not see time in a linear way. We see it in a circle of time. And so these conversations that I am having may not come to fruition in my lifetime, but I have to be brave and start the conversation And maybe in many, many years to come, when my grandson may one day stand here as well, can share with all of you how we've held the law for the land and not the law of man, and we've brought justice for rivers, not just in our nation, but right across the world.
I'm going to get you to be our law professor and give us some nuts and bolts now. So what are rights and how do they work? And especially in Australia where we don't actually have a Bill of Rights for people.
Yeah. So I mean, rights are a legal fiction, if you like. They're something that we can give different to corporations. Like we make decisions in law about who we give rights to and who we don't. Usually when we're thinking about rights of nature, I mean, the law differs all around, but there are usually rights to flourish, to exist, to regenerate and continue to evolve. So there are these specifically articulated rights that we see all across the world in rights of nature legislation. In the context of Australia, we don't have a strong rights culture. We don't have a federal Bill of Rights for individual people. So here I think the conversation's not quite as sophisticated as in other countries who are used to thinking and talking in terms of rights. And so one of the things that Anne was just talking about that we might want to pick up on in the conversation is when you talk a lot about the local community and the local people articulating what justice looks like for them. And it might be that that occurs in the language of rights, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. It could be that in the context of a country like Australia, obligations, responsibility, stewardship, or some framing that we're not used to yet, but which comes up from the local people who have a relationship to a place, it could be that that becomes the language that we want to talk about protection in. But in terms of nature, it's really those rights to exist, flourish, and to continue to evolve. They're similar to what we give to people, but they're quite specific as well to natural systems.
And the conversation earlier talked about the idea of, you know, the right to sue and be sued. Now that's an interesting concept. You know, like is there a danger that if we give rivers and natural places rights, that we'll just sue the river when it floods us? Is that a possibility?
I was thinking about, I mean, Erin before mentioned Christopher Stone's paper, Should Trees Have Standing? It was written in 1972. Some of you have probably read it. The very first review of that paper that appeared in a law journal was a poem. It wasn't taken seriously enough to give a sophisticated critique. And the poem was saying things like, what if a tree drops its leaves on my car? Can I sue the tree? So this kind of worry, if we start granting nature rights, we would be able to sue it in return, has been there from the very beginning. And I think perhaps the context in Australia that we think about it is in terms of a flood. So if there is a flood and it destroys houses, could we then sue the river? I mean, I think it's very tricky to know what that looks like in practice. So I tend to think about rights as being non-reciprocal, that we can have the capacity to be the guardian or to speak on behalf of a river, for example, and to enforce its rights. But I think it's a much trickier thing to imagine what it could like to sue a natural system.
Yeah. True. And I think too, like often when people are a bit litigious, I'm thinking, you know, one, Donald Trump, person you may have heard of, that they tend to sue people who might have some money. So I'm not sure whether many rivers have Swiss bank accounts that...
That's an interesting, There's two layers to that response. One is that as rivers gain legal personhood, they are also being invested with funding. So in Aotearoa, New Zealand, the Whanganui River, as part of the settlement, there was a $30 million contestable fund that was made available for the management of the river. So that's not perhaps worth an extremely avant-garde legal case, but it is enough money, potentially, for someone to sue. But I think the danger with the rights and the can I sue the river, it's twofold. One, we we immediately entrench this adversarial relationship.
Yes.
So instead of thinking about rivers in this relational way that Anne is talking about, beings with whom we are in a relationship, a reciprocal relationship that we owe obligations to and that in turn support and nurture us, we start to see the rivers as competitors. Mm. And that in turn engenders fear. So some of the first things that can happen when nature gets rights, particularly in places like the United States, is that people who see those rights as a weapon pointed at them will immediately sue to challenge the validity of those rights. And so we've seen a number of ecosystems in the United States gain rights and then immediately lose them. And that not only takes away the rights of nature, but it continues to fracture the community. So instead of something that could bring people together, you have this entrenched adversarial response where people are so afraid they're acting first. And if you remain on the side of nature, then you are opposed to the farmers or the developers or the other members of your community. So legal rights have been, I think, definitely a two-edged sword when it comes to nature's interests.
That's really interesting that you should say that, because so many of the things we talk about in the environmental field, like the tragedy of the commons and different scenarios in which nature suffers, often it stems from those cultural things, not necessarily physics or whether that, but it's these cultural things of people, human systems that are more competitive than cooperative, and that whole desire to change the conversation, like let's stop talking in adversarial terms, let's talk more about group and partnership. I'm very open to anyone who wants to answer. My thought is, if we talk about rights, and anyone who's got teenagers, they might have had conversations about, rights, and then we say, well, for every right that you have, there's a responsibility. Do you have any thoughts on, do we need to extend this conversation about rights to rights and responsibilities? Who wants to go first?
Yeah, I just want to pick up on the point about rivers being responsible for the flooding. In Western Australia in January, we just had the largest flood ever known in the history of Western Australia. And everyone who came from outside said, look what the river has done. Mm. And what the elders have said is, it's not the river that's done this. This is man-made induced climate change. Mm. Climate change is real, people. You know what I mean? So we have to think. We have to think about the causation of the problem and who's actually championed that as, the destruction. Because one of the things we hold as Indigenous people is that everything around us is alive. The rocks, the trees, everything has a right to reach its full potential and grow into its full potential, whatever that may be. And so it's very, very interesting when we talk about, these sorts of rights and who's responsible. Out of the flooding story, I actually published a poem. And the poem was called, What Are the Humans Doing? So it's a flip, because it is all about relationship, but this idea of reciprocity must be built on respect and an open dialogue of cooperation, of being unified, of wanting to live in a pluriverse, because what we're dealing with is complexity. And that is why we need collective wisdom. And if we do not have the wisdom of the oldest living culture, with the oldest water industry in the world, then where are we going as Australians? So, this is really timely. And so it's very, very important when we look at these, it's all about relationship. It's all about reciprocity. It is all about respect. Are we respectful to our rivers when you see what we do to them? How we turn them into drains and sewage pipes and all of these sorts of things. How can we dance in a system that we have no respect for? So what I'm trying to do in terms of my writing into legal pluralism is say that we must learn to hear the rivers. We must learn to hear the living waters. The other day I was given an opportunity by Ian White, who's a professor in Canberra, and he said to me, oh, Anne, do you want to build a living water museum in the Kimberley? I said, we've already got one. It's called the Fitzroy. And so I'm pushing the boundaries with UNESCO to say that the river can be and is a living museum, We are creating walking trails to take people through it so they can hear and see the magnificence of this country, the river country. It is so globally biodiverse, unique. Not only is the biodiverse so different, but the cultural diversity is so different according to the valley tracts. We have one law, Wallangari law, for all of the nations along the river. So we have stood with the cooperative paradigm from the beginning of time. And what we're trying to teach and share with fellow Australians is that you too can feel your systems, these living waters. Stand with the tree, touch it before you go somewhere, hug it. And it's so, it sounds so strange, but one of my brothers is in his 80s. We walked through the country and we were showing how to do cultural burns and fire burns, and we had an amazing person with us, and he almost wept profusely because he realised that as someone who's been a land manager, particularly for pastoral stations, he had been burning country wrongly. And then he saw that someone had cut a branch of a tree and left it on the ground. And he just profusely wept, and this is an 85-year-old man, to understand that everything he had been doing, he had an epitome of what that right of that tree was, that somebody could cut it and use it, but to cut it and just leave it on the ground, he couldn't understand that relationship of how someone had devalued something so special. So rivers, they are magnificent. They find their own way. I was sharing, it's probably a story from the city, but someone said, we were talking about, you know, these different ways that we could put things together. And one of the sayings that some Aboriginal people have is, it doesn't matter that it's concrete, it's still country. And so rivers have been changed, they've been channeled different ways, but they find their own way. They come back in moments of time when we as human beings are ready to once again engage with them. So you can see when we're talking about legal pluralism, we're bringing in a whole range of values, ethics, virtues, of how we live in harmony and balance with place-based. Get to know your country, get to feel it, get to realise that you are part of it and that your DNA and your memory will be held by those rivers, because rivers are living beings with a spirit that continuously build new memories. Go and build yourself a new one here. Thank you.
What responsibilities do we have as well as rights?
I think this is where I'll bring in the example of the Birrarung again. So in 2017, the Victorian state government passed legislation to recognise the Birrarung, the Yarra River, as a living entity. And this makes the Birrarung the first and so far only river to be recognised in settler state law. And that's a very important distinction, because as Anne's been talking about, first law has long acknowledged the living status of rivers. But the Birrarung is the first time that the settler state has passed legislation to acknowledge the river in that way. It did not give the river legal personhood. It did not give the river rights. So what we have now is a piece of legislation that actually focuses almost exclusively on the relationship that people can have with the river. The river is alive, and so that asks people to think about, what relationship do you have with this river? How do you give effect to that relationship? What does it mean to you? Too many of us for too long have been in a relationship where we've just taken from the river, and we still do. The Birrarung supplies up to 70% of Melbourne's drinking water. It still operates, as I said, it becomes a stormwater drain in its lower reaches. It's highly polluted. It's performing a lot of services for people. And so we continue to ask, what can we take from the river? But in 2017, this legislation not only said the river is alive, but it also said we need a vision. We need the community who love the river to come together and say what we want for the river. And so we now have a 50-year vision, which is the lodestone of the legislation, that every other hook in that legislation comes back to say, how is this plan delivering on the 50-year vision for the river? So we've started to shift from what can we take to what do we want for the river. And because the river is alive and it has a voice, the Birrarung Council that I'm on, and this council mandatorily requires representation from Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and Bunurong, the traditional owners of the river, This legislation was also the first in Victoria's history to include the language of Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. It has a Woiwurrung title, which is Wiluktjin Birrurung Murrung, which translates to keep the river alive. And so this living entity becomes an agent and a collaborator in its own management. And so now we can start asking the question, well, how do we get there with the river? With the river as a partner. And that's a really profound shift. It's no longer about this conversation of rights and adversarial arrangements and competition. It's about collaboration and how do we work together.
Perhaps I just observe that the language that Erin and Anne have been using in response to this question, you will have heard the words relationship, reciprocity, and they are terms with deep meaning that we could spend a lot of time unpacking. There's a thought about the river or nature as having intrinsic value or being valued on its own terms, not because it provides a service to us. And each of these ideas are so much richer than the language of rights, which rights are incredibly useful if they've all you've got, or they're an incredibly useful shield against an overwhelming power. But they shouldn't be confused for relationships, reciprocity, obligations, valuing the river or the natural system on its own terms. That's in part because they're fundamentally individualistic tools. They're about competition. They're about adversarialism. And unless you're a very well-funded individual group, actually suing to get those protections could be out of the reach of many people. So the language that we're hearing from Erin and Anne in particular is so much richer around reciprocity, and I would argue that's a stronger basis upon which a justice claim could be based.
Well, it's all about love, really, isn't it? That you can't help it. You protect what you love. You nurture what you love. And, you know, it's something that, like, Anne, it absolutely shines through you, and I think, you know, all of us, I mean, you know, I think, you know, we are probably like-minded on the stage and possibly under this whole roof. But people who love nature, and there's so much we can learn from Indigenous people about that connection to country. You know what? Yet we live in a country where more people live in cities than in regional areas. People are increasingly living in the biggest McMansion on the smallest block that costs the least amount of money per square. What are people missing out on, and how do we get people back in touch with nature? I'll start off with you, Erin, on that.
I really thought that was going to go to Anne. Look, I think one of the things that really came through, I come from Melbourne. We were the most locked down city in the world during COVID. But one of the things which became really apparent to everyone in Melbourne was the crucial importance of green spaces. Right? Yeah. So if you can only travel 5 kilometres from your house and you can only leave the house for 1 hour a day, then getting to a green space. And our green spaces are mostly along our waterways. So many people were suddenly connecting with their waterways in ways that they hadn't been before. I said that Melburnians have long been a little bit embarrassed about our rivers. Many of our urban waterways are essentially concrete drains. The Yarra is brown. It's beautiful and I love it, but it is brown. I think the way into this connection is lowering the stakes. So we don't have to go and engage with a pristine piece of nature. In fact, the idea of nature as pristine and therefore separate from humans is deeply problematic, right? That entrenches our disconnection. So we need to start with the places where we are and find ways to treasure those and to see their importance. They make us feel better. They cradle us when we are feeling sad. They lift the gloom of months upon months of lockdown because they are spaces where we connect with the world around us. So seeing nature as a living being, again, it reminds us that we are in a relationship with it. And that immediately says, well, what kind of relationship do we want this to be? What what kind of relationship will make me proud of what I'm doing and who I am as a human? And how do I begin with the places that are most proximate to me, the ones that I already have an intimate relationship with? So true. Thank you.
I will go to Nyan. What's your thoughts on what are people missing out on and how do we reconnect them with nature?
I think one of the things people are missing out on, and I don't know how many of you sitting in the room today are aware that we have at a federal government level a policy called natural reserve systems around bioregional governance. And so every part of Australia has been mapped into bioregions. And it's absolutely magnificent to look at that, to understand that what we really should be doing, what we as Indigenous people have been doing in the Kimberley from the beginning of time, is looking at regional place-based governance as well. Not just the river system, but the whole region. So prior to invasion, we had, and we still hold, a law called the Wunan Law, which was a law of regional governance, of reciprocity, of sharing. Sharing the commons for the common good of all of us rather than for the multinational corporations. So it's a very, very important point that this, get this map, everyone sitting in the audience, get this map, see where your region is mapped out, and from there you can start to have a dialogue, because one of the things that may not also be on the radar is local government is not in the constitution. And so one of the things we've been looking at in terms of this country is what should that now be developed into? And the history of local government in the last 20 years, you need economy of scale, there's been forced amalgamations. Why don't we be brave and start to see and govern and lead from a regional perspective? I know, from a much bigger perspective. When I look at, as I said, we've had the flooding in the north, but Lismore, it was the people that came together to coalesce. Your neighbours, people you didn't know, they came together to create a sense of community. And I think we really need to go back to looking at how do we govern for the greater good of all of us within these common areas from a bioregional framework perspective. It is in place till 2030. I wish we would all start to get some serious investment so that we could look at these sorts of stories and share these stories, because we are talking about, really, at the end of the day, the elephant in the room is the destruction of our biosphere as human beings. And that's why I said the earth will right-size itself if we as humans are so stupid and we befall our own demise. Mother Earth will right-size herself, but she will be lonely without the vibration of human beings. So we have a provocation before us that says we need to look at how we manage ourselves from a regional collective rather than individual little siloed, top-down, centralised, toxic-powered governance. So it's about giving space to country. Yeah, so there is the solutions out there. They're actually right before us. We just don't open our eyes. My sister used to teach me, we see with our ears and we listen with our eyes. So we need to see the world from a different frame, something so close, so personal. But as Erin said, this conversation that we continually take from the rivers. And a couple of years ago, in about 2017, we also wrote a play called A Song for the Muddawar, and we took that to France and Germany and performed it there. Because Erin is right, we take, we very rarely give back. So it's about creating that new relationship, holding to a bond of obligation that we as Australians supposedly live in the driest continent in the world. So our rivers and our living water systems are so precious to our life and the life of everything around us.
So true. Peter, I'm going to reframe the question for you just slightly, because I know you've got children, and I think I'm often fascinated by this disconnection with nature, because it is a disconnection. I know my own children, the first things that they've responded to, like they're fascinated by like trees and the light in the trees and animals, and I think we're born curious and interested in nature, and then somehow the rat race drums it out of us. You know, from that philosophical point of view, how do we keep that connection in our children, in humans more broadly, so that as they become adults, they do feel those, their own rights and responsibilities.
possibilities.
Yeah. Well, I guess one of the things I really loved about your opening question, talking about a place of meaning to you, was that it made me think about where did I develop that connection to country or connection to nature. And if we went round and polled everyone here, everyone would have a story like that. They'd all be equally valuable and equally interesting. So we have it, and we're not alone in having it. A lot of people have that connection. I personally feel very lucky in that my kids just developed that organically and without any trouble. But as we grow up and as we get older, some of the real sicknesses in our culture become very hard to think outside of. One of those sicknesses is instrumental rationality. So nature is only important if it provides a service for us, if it contributes to economic growth. And that's such a common way of thinking that it almost appears natural, as though that's also the only way to think about it. How do you think outside of it when it's like the air you breathe? It's everywhere. I think I would think about some of what Anne was just talking about. You've given us plenty of examples of how to think outside of that way of thinking. Some of it is community-based common decision-making. Some of it is the poetry that you've spoken of, or the plays, because they're ways of connecting and communicating with people that isn't just about logic and facts and numbers, but which touches hearts and minds. And that's the ground floor central component about how we think about and encourage other people to think about nature in different ways outside of what value it produces in an economic sense.
Now we're getting towards the end of our time that we've had, but I think we could talk about this for a while. So I'm going to have a second last question, which might be the most important question. It's, as I was saying before, you know, we're probably preaching to the converted today. If you're here, you're possibly like-minded, and you care about nature having rights, and you care about a voice for the rivers. What can we do, what can the people in the audience do to make this change? How can we contribute to creating a society or writing the letters to our politicians? What things can we do practically to go out from under this roof and help be a force that brings about the change that we need? Who would like to go first with that? Okay, Erin.
So I would say take two things away from this conversation. If we want to affect change, the first thing is supporting the treaty process, supporting First Nations voices, amplify First Nations voices. Recognise we are on stolen land. We cannot make it right with the environment without addressing the elephant in the Australian room, which is the lack of treaty, which is the lie of Terra Nullius, which is the ongoing lie of Aqua Nullius, where we continue to assume that water is there for the taking as well. So the only way through this is with the leadership and partnership with Indigenous peoples. I am really lucky to work with Wurundjeri Woiwurrung very closely, and Uncle Dave Wandon, a Wurundjeri elder, talks about how we can walk together to heal country. And that is the starting point. I think the second starting point is to explicitly talk about values. And this is what Peter was saying before. If we don't talk exactly about what we mean, why we love rivers, why we love the world around us, why we have a responsibility to it, why we have an obligation to protect it, then it's too easy for our arguments about environmental protection to get co-opted by the capitalist framework. And then nature only has value because of the services it provides. And that's incredibly reductionist and damaging. So amplify traditional owner voices and talk about values.
And
yeah, I think following up with what Erin's saying, we need to shift from the me to the we, and we need to start to create our own relationship with the place that we're at. We don't need to go very far, it's right here. Remember what we said? It doesn't matter that it's concrete, it's still country. And so very, very important, create your new memories. This land has got so many different amazing places that you can go. Don't give up after the first attempt. Go and sit somewhere quietly, feel the land, hear the land. Understand that your DNA is embedded in this landscape. You are part of this nation as much as we are. And so if we are to dream the new dream, it must be a collective dream of all of us walking, talking, sharing together to have something that is not yet before us, but we have the potential to grow and dream something different. So I say, build your new memory, find that special place, engage it, walk with Indigenous people, understand what we're sharing and telling you, be a part of a new memory of freedom, of justice, of equity for all. Thank you.
When I first got involved in environmental activism, I was lucky enough that a woman called Nina Brown, who was part of the campaign to stop a nuclear waste dump in South Australia, working with the Kupedi Kunga Judah, the women of Kupedi. And she sat us down and she said three things. This is 20 years ago, but I think it remains some of the best advice I've heard. Be prepared to work with and be led by First Nations people. Don't do it by yourself, because it's isolating and the problems we face are scary and challenging. And try to check your ego. Your work in this movement may not be to lead it. It could be to amplify the voice of others, to support, but find out what your skill set is and what you like doing, and then figure out how that can add value to existing movements. That, to me, still remains very good advice.
Now I'm going to tell the panelists what the final sort of question is before I do the housekeeping, so that you've got time to think about it. All I'm going to ask is for you to just leave us with a final pearl of wisdom. So have a think about what the last thing that you want this audience to hear from you is, and I'll give you a chance to think about that while I then do some shameless cross-promotion. I do want to say that the next Planet Talk session will start at 4 p.m. and we'll be finding about whether seaweed can help save the world. So I think that will be a very interesting discussion topic. Also, now on Monday there is going to be one of the Planet Talks. You'll hear from someone called Sarah Wheeler, who is also from the Environment Institute. And Sarah and Peter are actually going to be recording a podcast episode of Eco Futures in 3 days' time, which is going to continue the flow of ideas, this discussion that we've had on water rights. So this is the Eco Futures Futurist podcast is an initiative of the Environment Institute. And if you want to put a question to them, then you can email environment@adelaide.edu.au. And then you can send them through your question and hear what Sarah and Peter have to say. But also you can subscribe to the Eco Futurist podcast to hear more about this and other topics and hear from others that are leading the way in shaping an environmentally sustainable future for everyone. So that's the shameless cross-promotion. What are the final words of wisdom from each of you? I'll start with you, Erin. Let's make you go second. Peter, you give us your pearl of wisdom.
I think I would just use my time to amplify, in particular, both of these voices, but Anne's in particular. And I think the struggle that we're undertaking to protect nature is First Nations led, it's decolonial, or it doesn't happen. So I think that's what I would do.
The pearl I would leave you with is that rivers around the world are gaining rights and recognition in law as living entities. Every single river that has gained that new status in law is beloved, but is heavily impacted. These are rivers facing some of the direst threats to their very existence. And they obtain this new legal status because people love them so desperately. They are looking for ways, new ways. They'll try anything to protect them. So I kind of, like, I love that this is a unifying feature. We're not reaching out around the world and trying to find the least impacted places and then protecting those and fencing them off. This is a movement born of the relationship between people and place. And that ultimately is the most important thing, that love that you have for the world around you, for its specialness, regardless of how impacted it is. And you can begin there.
I kind of just had to get the last word to Anne.
Yeah, I think when I started, I said that I write about lawful, awful laws. I think one of the things is that we are testosteroned out on science. People are no longer listening. We need a new way to tell the story, to bring the people with us, through dance, through song, through ceremony, through film, through different ways of going, okay, this has got my heart, my Leon, I'm going on the journey. I also think that each and every one of us sitting in the room need to be brave and test this theory. Can we build new memories with our living waters? Let's start with right now, today. Let's find a new way of moving forward. We are shifting from the we to the me, from the ego to the eco, and I think all of us in the room are standing today and saying we want to see and be in the world a different way. And it is Indigenous people who can take you on that journey. When you start to work with Indigenous people, you start to form a different relationship, your life will be totally changed. So what I'm saying is be brave, push the boundaries, get out there, connect with the people from this land, from Kaurna land. There are revolutionary thinkers here, Indigenous people, who have led the conversation on the changes in law and the way we see legal standing. Their voices need to be amplified, but we need a new way to tell the story if we are going to continue to dream. Thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of what's been a really powerful Planet Talk. You've been a really wonderful audience, but please join me in thanking our panellists, Peter and Anne. Thank you.